Good morning. You're listening to News Radio 1070 WINA Real Life with Jennifer Till, brought to you by Virginia National Bank. And this is the radio show that's dedicated to women who are ready to love life and make joy a part of the daily dialogue. And I just have such a woman sitting beside me right now who's so excited. You may have just heard her exclaiming on air before, just as we were getting started. I don't know about you, but I've had yet another busy, wonderful, wacky week. I spent the weekend with my family last weekend celebrating my dad's 83rd birthday, and that was really fun. And actually, I got a lot of time to work on our show this week, and I'm really excited to announce that we have a show Facebook page up now. In the past, I've just used at the time when I created it, I didn't realize it was kind of this conglomeration of my personal Facebook and my Real Life with Jennifer Till Facebook page. But now you can actually join the Facebook page at facebook.com/Real Life with Jennifer Till. So I'd really encourage you to do that, because we're going to be sending out information about the show through the Facebook page. So here we have the next 60 minutes that we can let be just about us and you. And I'd like to start with a breath practice this morning. And I invite you to close your eyes and drop back into your body if your mind has taken you other places. Allow yourself to feel this breath that you're taking in this moment right now, and what it feels like as it's leaving your body. And begin to look to see if there's anything that you are ready to release in your life. Any old stories that no longer fit for you. As you exhale, you can just release that and let it go. And let's continue the exploration a little further and see if there might be anything new that you would like to create in your life. Something that could be totally outrageous or very subtle. Let's breathe in to give it space and room to grow and flourish. So this morning, I am drinking some mint tea, and I'd like to invite you to get your favorite beverage and find a quiet place, because this is really, I am so excited about this show. Tomorrow, hundreds of millions of Christians worldwide will celebrate the resurrection of Jesus, an act of death returning to life that is a touchstone of faith and belief. There is a smaller but still sizable group for whom death and life has a different but no less profound connection. According to an informal survey conducted several years ago, 4 to 5% of all Americans have had a near-death experience, or NDE. That's approximately 15 million people in the United States, a number that certainly warrants serious investigation, research, and conversation, something with which both of my guests this morning agree, although both approach it from their own unique and personal perspective. And both share the absolute conviction that such an experience is, at its core, all about changes in one's state of consciousness. I'm joined this morning in the studio by PMH Atwater, and PMH is a researcher, a spiritualist, an author, a public speaker, a prayer chaplain, and last but certainly not least, a visionary, who, as the title of one of her books says, died three times in 1977. According to her biography on Wikipedia, she's a pioneer in subjects like near-death experiences, the after effects of spiritual experiences, transformations of consciousness, reality shifts, and future memory. And joining us by phone is Dr. Eben Alexander, an academic neurosurgeon for the last 25 years, including 15 years at Harvard Medical School and currently serving at UVA. In 2008, Dr. Alexander was overcome by bacterial meningitis, rendered comatose on a ventilator in the ICU, a state in which he persisted for the next 7 days. In his words, he says, "My story offers a critical key to the understanding of spirituality. The human part of my brain and neocortex died for a week. And in the midst of that, I had an extraordinary experience that could not have occurred in my brain given our current understanding of neuroscience. Welcome to both of you.
Al, it's good to be here.
Yeah. And Dr. Alexander, do we have you on the phone?
Yes, I am here. Oh. I hope you can hear me okay.
Yeah. We can hear you. And can you remind me, did I pronounce your first name? Is it Eben or Eben?
It's Eben. That's correct.
Okay. And may I call you Dr. Alexander this morning?
Yeah. That'd be great.
That's great. Thank you. And where are we talking to you from, Dr. Alexander?
Right now I'm in Winston-Salem. I'm visiting my mother who lives down here, and my sisters and all the kids are here, and we're having a really wonderful Easter.
Great. Oh, I'm so glad to hear it. Dr. Alexander, I'd like to start with you, and I have a question for you. You've been an academic neurosurgeon for 25 years, but your experience was relatively recent relative to your time in neurosurgery. As you were coming back out of the coma, you described it as being you were childlike again, sort of a rebirth as things started to piece themselves together. How did your previous 25 years experience help you to integrate the experience you had had and put it back together?
Well, it turns out when I say it was like a rebirth, it was actually very much like a rebirth because, in fact, all of my language, all of my memories of my life, all my knowledge about humans and Earth and everything were completely gone. So as I was coming out of all this, my very first memories had no language at all. And so really I had no knowledge, no recollection of all of my neuroscience and neurosurgical experience, in fact, of any of my experiences as human. All that was gone. So the origin of my coming out of the coma was really very pure, deep inside the spiritual experience, without having the knowledge of neuroscience at the time. It took about 3 weeks, probably, for my all of my memories and knowledge about neurosurgery and about neuroscience to come back up slowly, kind of in a staged fashion. So as I came out of coma, I just had this very rich, incredibly real, hyper-real experience from deep inside without being able to compare it during that time with my knowledge of neuroscience.
PMH is nodding her head.
Yes, yes, yes. Yes. So, hi, Eben.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine. Your story sounds like my story, you know.
That's what shocked me was there were so many similarities.
Oh, yeah.
Because I was not familiar with the near-death experience literature. I had read very little of it during my professional career. So when I came out of all this, it was all extremely bizarre, strange, incredibly real, and yet I didn't really know what to make of it. And I made sure I wrote down my entire story for about 2 months. My son advised me to do that without reading near-death experiences and without talking with the people who had been around me.
Good step.
I wrote the whole story down.
Yeah.
And I had that to work with. And then when I started reading about it and seeing all the similarities and experiences, it was shocking.
Well, you're like 15 million people. Welcome to the family.
Yes, it's wonderful.
Dr. Alexander, how is this whole subject viewed by your professional colleagues? You're in the medical profession.
Well, if the same experience that I had been reported to me by one of my patients, who had, you know, been that sick. I mean, my physicians were very surprised that I survived it, much less ended up having a full recovery. But I would have basically reassured them that we understand these phenomena and that we know that when the brain dies, we expect these certain kind of things. Many people report them. But the fact of the matter is, there were some very powerful clues in my experience that showed me that this was a very real experience, that it truly happened. It happened outside of this material realm, but it really happened in a realm that is, I think, even more real. call reality here in the material realm. And the clues were there for me to know. But I would have tried to reassure that patient that it was, that's what a dying brain does, and that, you know, that's all there was to it. And I would have been totally wrong. Mm. You know, it flies in the face of what we call the reductionist material kind of scientific view of neuroscience and how a neural network gives rise to consciousness. And I know now from my experience especially, but also from reading a whole lot more about the neuroscience of consciousness, which I think is an oxymoron, and I know that the consciousness of the mind is actually the primary ingredient there, and it has to do with what I now know about consciousness, but also from my experience, I know is very real. And these are not, you know, people say, oh, it's just in your mind, you know, and especially a very sick brain that's dying. And that's not the truth at all.
Well, what you're talking about is what we now have scientific verification for, that once there are no vital signs, no brainwave action at all, no pulse, no heartbeat, nothing at all, you can still have out-of-body experiences, clear, enhanced consciousness, self-identity with emotions, cognition, thought perception, full use of your faculties, and intact memories. And all of this when you have absolutely no vital signs at all, no brain activity at all. And because of this, because this has now been verified, medical science is now starting to turn and take a more serious look. They have to. But added to this, not just what's going on in the brain or not going on in the brain, what seems to be happening in another dimension on another level, what we also have to look at and are now starting to look at is the after effects. And the after effects are not just psychological. You know, you don't just lose your fear of death. You don't just come back more loving and charitable. They're also physiological. It changes the body. You know, they're very definitive changes in the brain-mind assembly, like brain hemisphere dominance, changes in brain structure and brain function, definite changes in the nervous system, the digestive system, skin sensitivity. So we're talking about a dynamic here that is so impactful and so incredibly challenging that we absolutely have to look at it and look at it seriously.
Yeah, I would go so far as to say the thing that to me was the most problematic when I came back and trying to explain it from my old thinking was the fact that that experience was actually in so many ways much more real, much more interactive.
Right.
I had, in fact, a far better my ability in terms of my thinking and awareness was even better than I've ever had before or since in human form. And
well,
that,
you know,
part was very hard to understand.
That's one of the signature features of the near-death experience. You come back smarter than you were before.
And,
literally.
And especially, you know, because the neuroscientific community, I know before, we would try and explain these things as a dying brain, and every bit of it was implying that you would be losing your abilities of awareness, where in fact they are so much greater.
Yeah,
and
they're
I'm
enhanced.
Still trying to understand why.
Absolutely
it works
enhanced.
That way.
Yeah, especially with children, especially up to about the age of 7 or 8, you get these just immense leaps in intelligence, in the ability to abstract. They're fantastic, especially the very, very little ones. In my research with children, up to about the age of not quite 6, if I look at these younger ones, and I'm including babies here, toddlers, even the unborn, and you know, anyone at any age can have a near-death experience, remember it, and with these little ones, when they're old enough to be proficient at language, it matches the adult experience. And with these little ones, I had 48% when we were old enough to take the standard IQ test. 48% were genius. Rates of 150 to 160 without genetic markers to account for it. You could trace the jump of intelligence back to when they had their near-death experience. So we're talking about profound changes in the human brain afterward. Certainly with some people more than others, of course, but you still see this jump. And it just opens up the brain in ways that we never thought it would do.
You're listening to News Radio 1070 WINA, Real Life with Jennifer Till. And I am delighted to tell you and share with you that this morning my guests are PMH Atwater, who is a pioneer in near-death experience research, and Dr. Eben Alexander, who is currently serving at UVA in academic neurosurgery. So, PMH, when you had your experience in 1977, there was really not a whole lot of research yet done, given that you're the pioneer of the research.
As far as I was concerned, none.
Yeah, and so how was it for you to come out of having had this experience in a world where people were not talking about it, and there hasn't been much research done?
Well, Raymond Moody had written his book. He wrote it in 1975,
okay.
And my experiences were in 1977.
Right.
So the book Life After Life was out there. But I had never heard of it, never heard of him, never heard of the book, never heard of the name Near Death. I had none of this kind of knowledge. And I had these three experiences in 3 months, and later that
these
year...
These three near-death experiences.
Three in 3 months,
mm-hmm.
Three deaths... Three near deaths, and then later that year I had three complete relapses. So everything was happening to me in threes. But in my third near death experience, I was told by what I call the voice like none other. I felt it to be of God, but that, you know, that's what I called it, the voice like none other. And I was told, quote, test revelation. You are to do the research, one book for each death. Book two and three were named, not book one. I was told what this meant, what was to be in each book, but not how to do the work. So it wasn't until later the next year, when I happened to be at O'Hare Airport, when Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was there and her plane was late, so... We sat like a couple of little schoolgirls on a bench jabbering away, and I told her about my three experiences, and she was the one who validated me, said it was a near-death experience and that I was a near-death survivor. She didn't use the word experiencer. She said survivor. And, you know, it's great to be validated. And I mean, that's so important for an experiencer to have some kind of validation. But still, what she never mentioned Raymond Moody, never mentioned the book at all, ever. And what she told me really created more questions in my mind than it gave me answers. And it was 2 months after meeting her that I began my work. And I couldn't have cared less about anything else going on in the world. I wanted to do this research. And I was doing it.
So other than, well, how fortuitous for you to bump into Elizabeth Kubler-Ross in the airport.
Well, yes, yes.
You know. That was meant to be.
Yeah. Fate stepped in.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Were you met with skepticism from your family, from, you know, people around you?
I'm sure I was, but I didn't pay any attention to
good,
most of
good
it.
For you.
I did have a psychologist at Boise State University who set me down and absolutely grilled me for a solid hour, attacked me, grilled me, criticized me, just everything negative you could think of. And when it was all through, I survived. And I said, I'm going to do this research because this is what I'm supposed to do. He says, okay, you passed the test. You're going to be able to do it.
So both of you have pointed to, at the very least, this idea of consciousness. And we need to take a short break. And when we come back from the break, I'd like to talk about what is consciousness and dive a little more deeply into those ideas of changes in consciousness. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to News Radio 1070 WINA, Real Life with Jennifer Till, brought to you by Virginia National Bank. And I have to tell you, I had another great experience with Virginia National Bank just yesterday. I was having a little problem with understanding one of my transactions, and I got on the phone with Brian, and he was just terrific. We got it resolved in no time flat. This morning, if you're just joining us, I'm so excited and honored to tell you that my guests are PMH Atwater. And PMH has told me when we met face-to-face this morning that she's a big fan of the show, and actually she had been one of our first callers. That was fun. And she's a researcher, and she has had three near-death experiences in 1977, and that's when her life shifted dramatically. And we're also joined this morning by Dr. Eben Alexander, who is a academic neurosurgeon over at UVA, and he also has had a near-death experience. And yesterday on my Facebook page, I had asked the question if anybody knows anybody who's had a near-death experience, and we got a number of responses, one of which I would like to share with you from Eliezer Sobel. He's written a book called The 99th Monkey. We all know time is short, and so it's good to always keep in mind that what the famous Tibetan yogi, I'm not going to say this name correctly, Milarepa, once said, "You people who gather here think that death will come sauntering over you. No, whenever death comes, it strikes like lightning." Eliezer then goes on to say, "I got caught in a riptide in the Outer Banks of North Carolina a few summers ago and didn't know that the trick is to swim parallel to the shore as opposed to panicking and thrashing about wildly and coming extremely close to drowning, close enough to get a glimpse of the shocking recognition, oh my God, I'm actually drowning. This is it. I can't believe it. I'm dying today." Milarepa was right. It did feel like lightning coming out of nowhere when I least expected it. There are lots of stories about people who emerge from such experiences with a renewed sense of aliveness and appreciation and begin living with more passion and making major lifestyle changes and so on. Leave it to me to be the one guy who manages to blow a near-death experience and just carry on as if nothing much had happened. He did give me permission to read that, by the way, on the air. So, PMH, can you share with us what are some of the common experiences across the near-death experience?
Well, the main elements, the number one is the out-of-body experience. And it's not like you're sitting down and you're having an normal out-of-body experience, or maybe, you know, you're not feeling well and suddenly you're out of your body. No, these are very intense, detailed, coherent, often very long and very accurate experience, extremely intense. So that's the number one, adults and children, the out-of-body experience. Number two is that light, you know, and it's not like a yard light or a flashlight or even a bright halogen light. We're talking about a light that is described by adults as brighter than a million suns. So we're talking about a light that is beyond light. And there's something about this light. It is so intelligent and so all-knowing. It knows your name. It knows all about you. It can converse with you. There's something very loving and special and extraordinary about this light. And the third most reported element is a greeter of some kind. That can be a loved one who's died and gone on before. It can be a pet, even an animal who has died and gone on before that you know, or even that you don't know. It can be a religious figure, an angel, a light being. You know, if you're in, for instance, another country, let's say Thailand, and you had an experience like this, The people over there call them Yamatoots. You know, they're meant by Yamatoots. So a greeter of some kind. And then after that, I would say the Life Review. There really aren't that many people who report a tunnel. And you can trace the idea or the thought or the word of tunnels back to that time when the media sensationalized Raymond Moody's first book, Life After Life. You can trace it back then. For instance, in 1982, when Gallup poll did their first scientific survey of near-death experiences, they found that only 9% of the people ever reported anything like a tunnel. In other parts of the world, they don't have that word. They don't know anything about tunnels. It's only been primarily in the United States, Australia, maybe Europe. And it's these people that are exposed to Raymond Moody's book. Now, some people do indeed experience this, but it's not that many.
Dr. Alexander, what's your experience of these common experiences?
Well, to me, I think the striking thing, as I said, was I spent 2 months writing down everything I could remember from my experience without reviewing or without reading anything about the near-death literature. And then when I started to read it, it was stunning to me, all of the similarities. And I think everything that PMH has said has summarized it very, very well. There certainly was no tunnel for me, just this incredibly brilliant, very colorful, interactive experience. And an angel, this beautiful girl beside me on the wing of a butterfly, and I had no body image or anything. It was very kind of striking and real and repeated several times through the experience. It was just absolutely amazing how it all fit together so well and how it was shown so many things. And, of course, for a long time, as I was coming back and had my neuroscientific mind coming back over several weeks, and then when I was trying to explain it all later, it was striking all of the similarities, that all these stories seem to be the same. They often involve very intricate life reviews where people can quickly relive so many of the moments of their life. Now, that was not a feature in mine, which was kind of, to me, initially was kind of surprising, but also I was told as I left that beautiful verdant valley after fully appreciating the divinity and that who I call the omniscient, a little different name from what PMH came up with, but in my initial writings, I called this kind of infinite awareness, the omniscient. I think by anybody's definition, the correct name would be God, even though I also realize that any name is really very limiting and in that sense is a bit of an injustice. But the omniscient told me I would be going back. And I didn't have any idea what that meant because I didn't remember where I'd come from. But the to me, the big challenge was, well, how in the world did all that get laid down in my memory? And I think a lot of what PMH was saying earlier about the differences in how children and adults often come back after this experience would probably give me some clues about how it gets laid down in memory, because this is all experience that happens totally outside of the brain. And that was the part that, as a neuroscientist, it was very difficult to accept, and I went through multiple hypotheses about my experience, and really at the end of the day had to conclude that these are very rich conscious experiences completely independent of the brain. And that part is kind of stunning, but once you appreciate what that really tells you, it really opens up the door to a much wider view of human experience and what's really going on here.
You're listening to News Radio 1070 WINA, Real Life with Jennifer Till, and I'm joined this morning by PMH Atwater, who is a pioneer researcher in the field of near-death experience, and Dr. Eben Alexander, who is an academic neurosurgeon here at UVA in Charlottesville. So where would you say, Dr. Alexander, consciousness exists, if it's not in the brain or in the mind?
Well, I think there one depends a little bit on how you're going to define mind.
Okay.
I would say that consciousness is actually the primary part of our reality, and that a lot of what we see is kind of the material world and reality of what our brain constructs is actually derived from the more fundamental element of mind or conscious awareness, which is something that occurs it's in another realm. It's outside of this world of quarks, electrons, neutrons, protons, you know, the kind of scientific worldview does not begin to explain what conscious awareness is. And, of course, my assumption for all those years working in the academic neurosurgical realm was that the brain and the complexities of neuronal connections and of the signal timing, the signals in space and time, is what makes mind and soul and awareness and all that. And I now realize that it actually works the other way around. And I don't pretend to have all of the answers, but I can tell you that the consciousness is actually the primary ingredient, and the mind really gives rise to the brain, not the other way around.
Well, what most experiencers come back with is the idea that everything is conscious. There is nothing that's not aware. Even inert matter, even a rock, even a tree, everything has consciousness. Even air, that there's nothing that is not conscious and aware and responsive and has memory and can react and respond to feeling. So this seems to be really an understanding that most adults and children come back with. And I want to interject here the idea that there are different types of experiences. I want to interject the idea that there is an overall pattern. And when I say overall pattern, I'm speaking worldwide. But the elements in that pattern may differ, and certainly the way we describe our experiences is really constrained by the language we use and our background and our culture. So those kind of words, those kind of descriptions, those kind of responses will depend on the individual. But the pattern itself is universal. And when we're talking about patterns, I found four. I call the first one initial because it can, you know, it only takes like one, maybe two elements to come, if intense enough, will completely change that individual's life. Something like the loving nothingness, the friendly dark, a quick in and out of body experience, just hearing a special voice. Or something I call the unpleasant or the hellish experience. Certainly, not all of these experiences are fun or enjoyable or loving. Many of them are quite the opposite. Then the more pleasant or heaven-like experience. You know, most of our books and TV shows and radio shows are based on this, where, in fact, not even half of the people have this kind of experience. And then the other one I call the transcendent experience. And these are more complicated. They're usually longer. Very seldom do they have anything to do with a life review or anything to do with that which is personal. Rather, they have to do with the human family or history or this idea of a master plan, who we are as a human race or humankind. These people are just as apt to hop a light ray and tour the universe as they are to wind up in some kind of heavenly college taking classes. So they really challenge us to this idea of the hereafter, this idea of the afterlife. Maybe there really is an afterlife. And, you know, one of the things that really is special today, with tomorrow being Easter, yesterday being Good Friday, you know, here we are at that very, very cradle of life and death. And the one repeating words that thousands of experiencers have told me, always the same four words, always the same four words. And that is, always there is life. Four words, always there is life. Now, if you really look at that, then there is no afterlife. There is no before life. There is no now life. There is only life in some dimension, in some form, in some manner. It's all life.
You're listening to News Radio 1070 WINA, Real Life with Jennifer Till. And if you're just joining us this morning, my guests are PMH Atwater, who is an author of how many books now? Three?
Oh, my goodness, no.
Way more than the three that you were told to write.
Yeah.
First quarter of the day.
and pioneer in near-death experience research. And we're also joined this morning by Dr. Eben Alexander, who is an academic neurosurgeon at UVA. And Dr. Alexander, how has your experience changed your approach to neurosurgery?
It's changed my approach to really everything in life. It has everything to do with realizing that incredible, profound mystery and power of that conscious awareness within each and every one of us. And that is such a fundamental part of the universe, and far more important. I mean, I think my view from my medical training and from all my time in neurosurgery before I went into coma, basically looked at kind of consciousness in humans and in consciousness and other life forms as being something that kind of was derived at the end of the day by a very long process of the unlikely event of life on Earth, and then the long and arduous Darwinian selection finally coming up with sentient beings. And what I came to realize is that sentience is actually at the very beginning and core of all of this reality. So it's a completely different way of looking at what consciousness is. And I can tell you the neuroscience of consciousness really is very much an oxymoron. I think consciousness is such a profound mystery. It's probably what's called the hard problem of consciousness is by far the biggest question in modern science that cannot be even put into proper words. We don't even know where to start in defining what consciousness is. And this is something that's been kind of bubbling to the top for at least 30 years now, that we need a new physics and a new science to even begin to describe the mechanism of what we all know and feel as our conscious awareness. So it's completely changed how I look at the world and at human existence, and knowing so much more now about how that consciousness is actually the primary part. I think it's important to point out, and especially speaking as a neuroscientist, that little voice of awareness, that kind of thinking voice in our brain, in many ways is more a spectator. Our brain, at a subconscious level, is doing amazing amount of processing and pattern recognition of the universe. And so when I talk about kind of a deep conscious awareness and exploration, that doesn't mean educating that voice to know a lot more about, this material world. There are ways to get deep into consciousness that go far beyond what that voice of kind of rational thinking is able to indicate about what's going on. I think that's part of the challenge for people who have a very serious interest in consciousness, is how do we actually get much deeper into it? And it's not necessarily just by educating that brain, that speaking rational voice, and giving it a better view, better worldview. There are more profound ways that have to do with meditation, prayer, and recently I've been doing a lot more with the Monroe Institute in Virginia, just south of Charlottesville, where I think they have a very sophisticated kind of way and philosophy about getting much deeper into consciousness. And that's what I've been exploring recently and trying to get a better understanding of this.
PMH, we just have a minute or two left. Is there anything you want to make sure we hear before we end the show?
My book.
Oh, well, yeah, of course. Thank you. So your book is Near-Death Experiences, The Rest of the Story.
Right. It's now out. It's a summation of 33 years of work. So if you want to dig deeper into the near-death experience, the spiritual aspects, the brain aspects, children, adults, transformations of consciousness, what they are, why we have them, where they lead us, not just near-death experiences, but the larger impact of spiritual experiences, get that book, Near-Death Experiences, The Rest of the Story. It's now out everywhere.
We can get it at the local bookstores,
right,
or Amazon.
Right, you get it at Quest or okay. Barnes & Noble or
right.
Anywhere.
Right, so this conversation has just been a teaser to the content in your book, it sounds like.
Oh, right.
And we can also find you at PMHAtwater.com.
Right.
Right? Okay, thank you so much, PMH. It's been delightful. And Dr. Alexander, ReconciliationLife.com is where we can find you. Is that right?
Right, exactly. I'm working on the book now.
Well, thank you so much. And until next Saturday morning at 8 a.m., remember to ask yourself, what's the kindest thing I can do for me right now? See you next week.